Her face didn't bother Debbie one bit. She refused to flinch, stayed right in front of me. I said to myself, this bitch is crazy, you know? You gonna shoot something? Shoot me, Debbie said. I took most challenges, but not this one. I pointed the gun away from her. She moved in front of it. Deborah, stop, I said. Then put the gun down now, she demanded. Fuck you. I ordered Deborah and her friends outside. Not that anything changed. We just yelled at each other in the driveway. A moment later, they decided enough was enough and made a beeline for my Mercedes, obviously planning a speedy getaway. But I stopped that by jumping between them and opening fire on my car. I thought it was fair myself. My wife was going to leave me. I said, not in this motherfucker you ain't. You may be leaving, but you're going to be walking away from this motherfucker because I'm going to kill this here. So go get them hush puppies and get your ass down the road. Then I opened fire. I shot one of them tires. Boom! That tire said, ah, sounded good to me. I shot another one. Oh! The vodka I was drinking said, go ahead. Shoot something else. I shot the motor, but the motor fell out. The motor said, fuck it. I was the last one who could explain why I did such a stupid thing, but apparently I'm sorry wasn't enough. One of the women called the police. If you want to get a cop to respond quickly, all you have to say is, hello, officer, I want to report a black man with a gun. It's like announcing the start of hunting season at an NRA convention. The cops arrived so fast, I barely had time to run inside and smoke all my dope. Then the police came. I went into the house, because they got magnums too. And they don't kill cars. They kill niggas. They arrested me for assault with a deadly weapon. I went to jail and was freed on bail later that day. The charges were dropped in February. Within 6 months, Deborah and I were officially divorced and back to being friends. I probably should have given my love life a vacation. Maybe taken a decade or two off. Instead, I grabbed hold of Jenny and lulled her into the calm center of my hurricane. What's wrong? She said. Are you trying to catch a train? It was the first time we made love. What do you mean? I asked. Slow down. She said, slow down. I wish it had been possible. From the beginning, Jenny and I were mismatched lovers who couldn't get over thinking how lucky we were to have found each other. She came into the picture knowing exactly what to say and do to inspire my mind and excite the rest of me. To her, I was one in a million, a prince who didn't see his royal standing. And I felt elevated around Jenny. In this well-bred, college-educated beauty, I thought I might have found somebody who could love me so hard and passionately that I'd finally be able to love myself. But our relationship was marred by a tragic weakness that would nearly destroy both of us. Jenny was almost as big a dope dummy as me. In a test of wills, she was as strong and stubborn as me. She drank with me. She snorted coke with me. But the worst of our secrets was shared the first time I slapped her. When a man hits a woman, one of two things happens. Either she hauls ass in the opposite direction, or she becomes yours. Violence is like voodoo. The sting is like a hex. You become possessed by each other, locked in a diabolical dance. I lived in that dark place you go when you grow up with people telling you that you aren't worth shit. And Jennifer, bless her heart, followed me down that destructive path. Whether we were vacationing in Maui, locked behind the gates at my house or on the road, we never left that faraway place where passion met brutality. It gripped us both equally. I broke furniture. She threw bottles. We ripped each other's clothes. Even the lighter, innocent moments were tinged with red. One night we were in my study when I leaned across the desk and told her that I wanted to suck her pussy. Say that again and I'll hit you in the nose, she said. I scooted closer. I spoke slower. I want to suck your pussy. Suddenly, she popped me in the face. Boom! I smothered the sting with my hand and saw that it was covered with blood. Jenny ran downstairs and roused all 350 pounds of my Uncle Dickie from in front of the TV in the kitchen. Help me, help me, she screamed. I hit Richard and he's bleeding. Uncle Dickie hadn't budged when I entered the scene. Where is she? I'm gonna kill the bitch. Moments later, it was like nothing happened. I apologized. I promised it wouldn't happen again. Just stay with me, baby, I said. Don't leave. And she didn't. I didn't excuse such behavior. In all honesty, I didn't even think about it. From as far back as I can remember, I saw men handle their women with a certain roughness. One time as a child, I followed my father and stepmother up the stairs of our house, watching as my dad beat the crap out of Viola. It was very upsetting. It wasn't a fair fight. I knew he shouldn't have been beating her. Daddy, don't hit her, I pleaded. Don't hit her no more. He turned around. This is my woman, he snapped. Now you get your ass back down those steps and mind your own business. I remember my mother and father was fighting once, and I was going to jump in, Jack. Not my mother, motherfucker. But he beat the shit out of me. Nigga, what the fuck? That's my mama. That's my woman, motherfucker. I never understood. I always wondered if maybe she liked him kicking her ass, or maybe it was a man thing to do. It wasn't until later I realized that letting them go is the man thing to do. But it's hard to be that strong. When I took Jenny to Peoria, it was to show her all the sights and people of my youth, the places where I'd grown up and hung out. I wanted her to see what I couldn't describe, the smells and details, the colors and the sounds. But whether or not I realized it, I was also putting her in the midst of my long-time struggle to break free from a past that was often more powerful than I was able to admit. From their visits to L.A., I already knew most of my family weren't too fond of Jenny. They sensed she had the grit and determination to help me pull away from them, and they feared that more than anything. Mine was a family of survivors. They enjoyed my fame and fortune. They were extremely happy that I'd made a better life for myself. But at the same time, they felt that my success also entitled them to a better life. So when Jenny and I settled into Mama's, they made sure that I knew my place. Mama served soul food. Uncle Dickie started a poker game. Cousins, aunts, and uncles and friends of theirs appeared from out of nowhere. The hours passed. Jenny went to bed. Dickie arranged for women to come by. The sun rose and they started the same shit all over again. Never forget where you come from, Rich. Remember your roots, son. Where would you be if not for all the material we've been giving you? Shit, I feel like I wrote half your act. I could only take so much. Then I burst. I looked at Mama, at the others. I was famous. The New York Times loved me. I lived in a mansion with a swimming pool and tennis court. I bought some of these people their homes, paid their mortgages, given them cars. None of it mattered. Suddenly, I was crying like a baby. You never loved me. Ever since I was a little boy, you wanted me to be a pimp. I couldn't do it. At 38 years old, I was crying the tears they never let me. The tears I never let myself cry. Let me be who I am, goddammit. You want me to be like all of you, stuck here in Peoria, doing nothing with your lives. Mama tried calming me down. And you took me away from my mother, I continued. I loved her. Didn't you know that, Mama? A few hours later, Mama got me one of her whores, and I left Jenny alone with her guitar to sing the blues. Our blues. That was the drill. The tug of war. I apologized and we went back home to L.A. Then something happened inside me. One summer night, Jennifer and I were driving home from a dinner party at a friend's house when I abruptly turned the car around and drove to the Comedy Store. I hadn't been there for months, but when we arrived there, I waited my turn and then climbed on stage and ended a long drought between stand-up performances. Bonded by a great sense of purpose, me delivering the best comedy of my career, Jenny and I became inseparable, even dependent on each other. Jenny picked out my clothes. She dressed me in Armani suits and made sure to stick a gardenia in my jacket lapel before I went on stage. She sat in the back of the Comedy Store and took notes. In the morning, we ate breakfast by the pool and critiqued and honed routines that became the heart of my concert movie, Wanted, Richard Pryor Live in Concert, to comedy perfection. Jenny praised me for telling the truth, for being able to take my life and turn it into a funny theater of the absurd. However, it wasn't only me. My life worked for me. For instance, before Jenny and I went on vacation in Hana, she fired the housekeeper and replaced her with a weekend maid. A few days later, the maid telephoned us in Hawaii sobbing and hysterical. She'd left my cousin's Great Dane in the backyard with my miniature horse, Ginger.
"Oh, Mr. Pryor," she cried. "Ginger was eaten. The dog ate her."
I remember the first time the dog saw the horse. They thought it was another dog. My cousin had a Great Dane staying with us. They ran over to see the horse, and then that smell hit their ass. "Hey, that ain't no goddamn dog.
You smell that shit? Ain't no dog in the world shit like that, Jack."
Great Dane say, "I don't know what it is, but I'm gonna fuck it."
Come back and say,
"Can't fuck it." Other ones say, "Well, let's eat the bitch." One night, Jenny and I made love. First, I had an orgasm, and she didn't. I pounded my chest. She called me Macho Man. "I don't give a damn if you come or not, 'cause I'm Macho Man." Then she had an orgasm. And you can tell when you made good love to your woman, right? 'Cause she will go to sleep. That's when you really are Macho Man. One day, Jenny demanded credit for that bit. I said, "Go register it at the Writers Guild, then we'll talk." After working all summer at the Comedy Store, I set out on a large tour that fall. The hall sold out. The reviews were worshipful. There was nothing better than spending an hour and a half on stage, making people laugh. With the comedy guy smiling down on me, I was in heaven. But the feeling was short-lived. The time I spent by myself between shows was hellish. I hated being alone. I was my own worst company. After one show, David Banks and I were hustled by bodyguards to a waiting limo. A moment later, I ordered the driver to turn around and the bodyguards to relax. "You did too good of a job," I said to them. "Now, we're going to go back and this time let a few women through, okay?" Fortunately, Jenny was with me most of the time. She prompted me to read books, visit museums, and see shows. She kept me fully engaged in real life rather than allowing me to indulge my inclination to sit in a darkened room doing dope and entertaining lowlifes. Sometimes her task was easy. Other times we fought without remorse. The year closed on a dark note. At the end of December, my grandmother suffered a severe stroke. Gravely ill, she didn't appear long for the world. Jenny and I flew to Peoria so I could be by her bedside. Even then, I was conflicted between past and present, between my family and my future. Knowing my grandmother didn't like Jennifer, I nonetheless escorted her into the hospital room to sit with me. Seeing my grandmother dying was difficult for me to face. I needed Jenny's support, and I said so. Mama, I said, motioning toward Jenny, this is the woman I love. Rather than respond, she reached out and touched my overcoat, which she had bought me. She rubbed it with two brittle, bent fingers. Are you cold, Mama? I asked. Her lips moved, but I couldn't hear what she was saying. Then Jenny filled me in on what was really going on. She's not cold, Richard, she whispered. She just wants to be loving. She's trying to love you. That was nice, Mama.
It feels like blue azure,
Mama managed to say. Yes, Mama, and it's warm. Very warm. Thank you. Though sick and inches from death, she was still a formidable woman in her own way. Her doctors were trying to put a tube up inside her, but she wasn't letting them. Desperate to help, I stood in the doorway, tears running down my face, and told her that if she didn't let them work on her, I'd do it myself. Before I left, I saw her relax. I guess she knew. I never saw anyone deal with death like that. I mean, serene and shit, you know? Me? I'd be screaming, Death, get the fuck away from me! But Marie, she took it calmly. A few hours after I left her room, she died. Yes, she did. She died. And that was something. 24. 5 years earlier, I had looked out from the cover of a record album with a funny face and a wry look in my eyes and said, That nigger's crazy. It had been a joke, but after Mama died, nothing struck me as funny. The world was mine. My concert movie, Wanted, was an instant smash after opening in October. Reviewers seemed grateful that, after so many big-screen misfires, my brand of humor had finally been successfully captured on film. Then Hollywood, which loves a hit movie, also seemed to rediscover me. Surely I wasn't white. Suddenly I wasn't black either. I was green. But as Kermit the Frog said, it's not easy being green. Projects were heaped at my feet, a sequel to The Sting with Lily Tomlin. Neil Simon wanted to write Macho Man for his wife Marsha Mason and me. Producer Ray Stark brought me The Toy and Family Dreams. Through my own deals with studios, I talked about developing a movie based on George Orwell's Animal Farm and remaking Arsenic and Old Lace. I was also offered the lead in a film based on the life of jazz great Charlie Parker. But it seemed too much to handle. Instead of taking advantage of being a hot commodity, I was awash in a depression which had crashed over me following Mama's death. I truly felt as if I was flailing underwater, stuck in a surreal nightmare. Despite whatever problems I had dealing with my grandmother, she had always been my anchor, my tether to some sense of reality. And with her gone, I began drifting and floating over the landscape, without any course. It was like the word game I had played with Chevy Chase on Saturday Night Live. Mama. Dead. Life. Death. Richard. No one dared think about how I might respond to that suggestion, except for Jennifer. The flow of hookers and my frequent all-night, sometimes week-long disappearances into the squalid home of a strung-out female drug dealer who plied me with my life's two essentials told her I was in trouble. These flights occurred every night rather than every now and then. Yet she stayed at my side, put up with me, berated me, and dragged my ass home. Any doubt that I was on a path to self-destruction was erased the day I emerged from the bath with half my mustache shaved off, then dressed in a red jogging suit, silver shoes, and a top hat, and announced that I was going out. Oh, really? She said. Where you going? Shuffling off to Buffalo. I grinned madly. After that, she checked my ass into a hospital. It was clear the egg had cracked. In the hospital, I spent a few days detoxing while under the thumb of some good sedatives. A contradiction in terms, if you want my opinion, though I wasn't complaining. Once my eyes cleared, I began talking to a psychiatrist, a scholarly-looking black man, who made me realize how affected I was by my grandmother's death. I told myself it didn't bother me, but it did. "Everybody's dying around me," I said. "It makes me scared." Ironically, I had a hard time in the therapist's office. All I had to do was talk about myself, but I found that painfully difficult. I figured it was too personal. But God bless him, the man tried. "What exactly about cocaine do you like?" he asked. "It fucks me up good. I like that ping it puts in my head." "Do you see how it removes you from reality, mentally as well as physically? You spend days and even weeks isolated in your house, alone in your bedroom, getting high." "Yeah, but that's okay." "Why is that? Why is it okay?" "I don't see any need to be in reality, because I've seen how ugly the world is." He didn't buy that shit. Not for an instant. Wanted to know how I was so confident of the world's ugliness when I wouldn't venture into it and check things out. He started asking me where I'd been, the places I thought were ugly, places I thought were nice, and finally, as if setting me up, he asked how I could make such extreme statements about the world when I'd never been to the origin of the world's beauty. "Okay, I bet." "Where's that?" I asked. "Africa." Excited after reading Richard Leakey's and Roger Lewin's Origins, Jennifer and I left for Kenya on Easter Sunday, 1979. From the moment we touched down at the small airport in Mombasa, I sensed something extraordinary. Through the jet lag, I knew something was different, but couldn't articulate it, couldn't get good reception. I strained to hear a beat that was too far away. However, I realized the shrink had been right. The place really was beautiful. My eyes were full. It was so beautiful. It was black. Blue black. Original black. The kind of place where you go, black. And landing at the airport in Nairobi, it just fills your heart up. You see everybody's black, and you realize that people are the same all over the world, because people in Africa fuck over your luggage just like people in New York. The next day we went to Nairobi, where the sensation of being in Africa grew even stronger. Something was indeed different, exciting, alive, but radically so. We took a tour of the National Museum, and that completely rearranged the cells in my brain. Did a whole rewiring trip on me. By the time I set my ass down in the hotel lobby, I knew what I was feeling. "Jennifer," I said, "you know what? There are no niggas here." She glanced around the hotel lobby. It was full of gorgeous black people, like every place else we'd been. The only people you saw were black. At the hotel, on television, in stores, on the street, in the newspapers, at restaurants, running the government, on advertisements, everywhere. "There are no niggas here," I repeated. "The people here, they still have their self-respect, their pride." Over the next week, we traveled into the bush. Settled into a lodge in the middle of Maasai territory. I loved their attractiveness, their ancient yet timeless tribal look, their ornate beads, their twisted, elongated earlobes, their pride and grandeur, and the way they stood guard over an earth that belonged to them before it belonged to any other humans. The animals were a different story. We went on a safari, not to shoot, only to look. But we still went deep into the jungle, driving until it felt as if we had driven to a different planet, It was so pretty. And there were no people, just monkeys, giraffes, elephants, hippos, jackals, and lions. Moving in packs, kicking up dust, looking for food. I couldn't take my eyes off a lion who was tearing into a Cape buffalo. Motherfucker ate like my dad. Oh, God damn, this is good shit. God damn. It wasn't no zoo. We all go to the zoo and fuck with the lions, cause the lion can't get out. You say, hey, lion, hey, motherfucker. But when you see a pride of lions, about 20 of them motherfuckers hanging out, they have a different attitude. They see you and say, yeah, get your ass out of the car. Bring the camera, too, cause we gonna eat all of that shit. After 3 weeks, I had no doubt that being in Africa had had a profound effect on me. It seemed especially so when it came time to return to the United States. The land had been timeless, the people majestic. I had seen and felt things impossible to experience any place else on earth. I left enlightened. I also left regretting ever having uttered the word nigger on a stage or off it. It was a wretched word. Its connotations weren't funny, even when people laughed. To this day, I wish I'd never said the word. I felt its lameness. It was misunderstood by people. They didn't get what I was talking about. Neither did I. I wish that I'd kept my mouth shut. But that was a hard thing to do, an impossible thing to do. It wasn't too late, though. And so I vowed never to say it again. One thing that happened to me that was magic was that I was leaving, sitting in the hotel lobby, and a voice said, what do you see? Look around. And I looked around, and I looked around, and I saw people of all colors and shapes. And the voice said, you see any niggas? I said, no. It said, you know why? 'Cause there aren't any. 'Cause I'd been there 3 weeks and hadn't said it. And it started making me cry, man. All that shit. All the acts I've been doing as an artist and comedian, speaking and trying to say something. And I've been saying that. That's a devastating fucking word. That has nothing to do with us. We are from a place where they first started people. In Africa. In Kenya. Dr. Leakey, a white anthropologist, which I have to say so white people will believe me, he found remains of a man that stood up and walked on the earth 5 million years ago. You know that motherfucker didn't speak French? I mean, black people, we are the first motherfuckers on the planet. My epiphany was highly personal. I would do what I could to make my feelings known at home. It was a vision that extended beyond black people and included people of all colors. My comedy was colorblind. None of it would have ever worked if the world was all one color. I mean, even black ain't beautiful if it's the only color you look at every day. Life's richness, its beauty and excitement come from the diversity of things, the multitude of colors that greet you when you step outside the door each day. I no longer wanted to be someone who pointed out the differences, especially racial ones. I wanted to help people see how similar all of us are. I came back home and thought of Malcolm's turnaround at the end, and how beautiful it was, and how people considered him a traitor for it. And it made me teary-eyed all over again, because he had been right. We're all just people. We're all the same. What else I found out in Africa is the fact that aside from us being from the original people, so are the white people. We all family. That's it, Jack. And fuck all that other shit, 'cause it don't mean nothing except about some cash. 25. Holy shit. I didn't expect the reaction I got when I disavowed the word nigger. Mooney and David Banks told me that people thought I'd gone soft, sold out, turned my back on the cause and all that political militant shit. I received death threats. Kooks showed up at my house, threw shit over the gate. I got letters and comments from people who thought they owned me and didn't want me to stray. It was the same as the struggle I had with my family when they said, "Don't forget where you came from." They wanted my voice to be theirs, and they didn't want mine to change. But I wasn't Malcolm Martin or anybody else. I was a drug-addicted, paranoid, frightened, lonely, sad, and frustrated comedian who had gotten too big for his britches. I'd wanted laughs, not racial struggles. I'd wanted to be liked, not hated. Overburdened, I'd walked too far out onto the wing, lifted too much weight, and finally I buckled under the pressure. I was terrified of the jacket. Confused, I squandered away the summer, working 2 days for $50,000 on the lame comedy In God We Trust and preparing for a major role co-starring with Cicely Tyson in Family Dreams, later retitled Bustin' Loose. But neither picture, when it came to facing facts, was of the caliber I should have been doing if my head hadn't been lost in a haze of vodka, coke, and anger. As it was, my finest performances were at home. Jenny and I acted like schizophrenic lovebirds, passionate one moment, attempting to murder each other the next, calling the cops, then persuading them nothing was wrong. This woman turned out to be just as tough and crazed as me. My Uncle Dickie used to say, "You know why? 'Cause the Irish are niggers turned inside out." Seemingly destined for the Domestic Violence Hall of Fame, we nearly rewrote the record book the night I stood in the living room, cranked to the gills, and grabbed my .357 revolver. I fired 3 rounds, then turned and pointed the gun at Jenny and ordered, "Get out, bitch!" 30 minutes later, when we made up, I said, "I'm glad you didn't make me kill you." It was classic. I was the victim. Nothing was my fault. I offered no apologies. Take my behavior on the set of Family Dreams in Seattle that October. Erratic and ornery from dope, I must have worn out Cicely to the point where she spoke to her husband, who called me one afternoon in my trailer, and in his own way asked me to shape up. "Rich," he said. Only one man in the world had that voice. "Miles?" "Rich. That's my woman." Then he hung up. Even so, I knew what he meant. But I was too far into the shit. "Sorry, brother." Needless to say, going to Dirty Dick's meant I had one thing on my mind, and it was no secret to anybody, because I was so goddamn open about using cocaine that it had become a cornerstone of my act, such as it was. When I walked into his place one afternoon in November 1979, I saw him going through this complicated process to fix up a tiny rock of 100% pure coke and then smoke it. It transfixed me. My feet might as well have been in cement blocks. I stared and tried to comprehend the nuances of the ritual. It was like watching someone do a new dance step. It looked cool. The expression on his face, total bliss, real out there. And when the motherfucker came down from that rocket blast, he looked at me like he'd just come. "Oh, man," he said. "Yeah? Yeah, Rich. You know, I just seen God." "God? Motherfucking God." When I first did it, I knew it was going to fuck me up, but I had to do it. Had to be hip. Motherfucker said, "You ever try this?" I thought, he's going to string me out. He's a dope dealer who needs me to get hooked so he can get some freebase. This dude used to snort a little coke, but I saw him and said, "What's wrong with you?" He said, "Have you ever freebased?" "Say what?" "Freebased."
He told me he saw Jesus.
Dirty Dick didn't have to ask if I wanted to try it. From the look in my eye, he just started to cook the rock. I'll do everything, he said. You just suck on the pipe. Like it was a chick's dick. Honest to God, I was scared that first time. I thought it was going to be something else. But it was nice. That was the worst part. That it was nice. In a terribly ominous, ironic forewarning of the calamity that lay ahead, I started a fire the first time I freebased at home. The rambling house was still, dark, and quiet. I was by myself behind closed doors in my bedroom, seated at a little table, chasing that first high. Rock, lighter, rum pipe. I thought that I was in touch with the Lord. Oh, Jesus, I muttered. Oh, God. I should have sensed right then the magic pipe was more than I could handle. But you don't have any sense when you smoke that shit. Jenny told me that when she came home, the place had the feel of a haunted house. If it wasn't ugly before, it was then. Strange. Spooky. Menace in the air. I heard her call me. But I didn't respond. When she walked into the bedroom, I was standing beside the bed, pipe in hand, and staring at the pink comforter, which was on fire. The room was filled with smoke. Flames danced at my feet as if grasping for me.
Richard!
She screamed. My assistant, Rashawn, ran in, grabbed the burning blanket, and took it outside. From Numbsville, I tried to explain.
I don't know what happened. I was just trying to light the pipe the way you're supposed to, but the rum on the cotton tip must have dropped on the blanket and...
As I dove deeper into the gloom, I corrupted those around me, missed a $100,000 one-day cameo in the biblical spoof Holy Moses, and barely noticed Christmas and New Year's. In less than a year, I'd gone from my artistic peak to personal pits. I didn't give a fuck. Didn't even notice. It started out innocently enough. Every now and then. A little bit. No, not now. No bass. Fuck it. Pretty soon, I noticed I wasn't walking as far away from the pipe as I used to. I used to put the pipe down and go, I'll be in here. And motherfuckers you used to share with come by and you say, hey, ain't you got some of your own shit? If you're unlucky, you sit and wait for someone to fix your rocks, and that's all you think about. When am I going to get my turn? The person who cooks has got all the power. I was fortunate. I had money. I cooked it myself. I was fascinated with shaking up the shit, cooking it, watching it bubble down, you know? I was like a kid watching magic, performing it myself. Spellbound by the power of turning powder to rock. You put it on the paper end and, bink, it would be a rock, you know. I was out one night and we was doing it, and the woman says, the fire don't last long enough. We kept trying to get it, and I said, what kind of fire do you want? The dude says, the kind that lasts forever. You want to know the difference between sniffing and smoking. Snorting, you get high. With bass, you hope you don't die. Bill Cosby had once said of me that the line between comedy and tragedy was a thin one. From where I stood on the eve of filming Stir Crazy in Tucson in early March, there was no line. My mind was somewhere other than on this crazy caper about two truck drivers who bust out of prison after being mistakenly convicted of robbery. I immediately set myself apart from co-star Gene Wilder and director Sidney Poitier. Rather than stay in the luxury hotel where they were encamped, I rented a ramshackle home in the hills that was as isolated as I was trying to make myself. My unwillingness to play team ball created tension as thick as the smoke in the pipe that prevented me from showing up for work until noon or later. Another fuck up. If unprofessionalism had been my only indiscretion, I might not have made so many enemies. But I lived up to my badass reputation by trying to make friends with the prisoners at the Arizona State Penitentiary, showing them that I was cool by getting them water and even sneaking them drugs. Shit, Rich. What were you trying to prove? I always said that the black man had been fucked over in the revolution. We're nice people. We just got a bad break. But I was there 6 weeks, and I talked to some of the brothers there. Thank God we got penitentiaries. I said to one, "Why'd you kill everybody in the house?" He said, "They was home." Although I was lucky to make it through the movie, I was even luckier not to have landed in jail alongside the murderers, thieves, and drug addicts like myself when I started buying coke through a connection with some motorcycle gangbangers. Unbeknownst to me, they were being monitored by state police and federal agents, including their visits to and from my trailer and my hillside house. We became targets, too. One night, Jennifer smelled cigarette smoke, and we heard the crunch of gravel outside my house. It wasn't merely my paranoia. Jennifer had been sober for months. We definitely were being watched. The next day, agents and cops were all over the set. For the first time that I knew of, I was in danger of getting busted. My dumbass solution? Confrontation. Show them who was hip. "I hear you guys are mad at me," I said to one of the federal narcs. "Sorry." They didn't give a shit about my sorry ass. "We suggest you don't buy any more dope while you're here," he said, "and if you try to leave the state with any, we'll arrest you." Fair warning. But I couldn't help but do whatever stash was left before returning to L.A. I even got to the airport, then ordered the driver to turn around so I could go back and dig up the emergency stuff I'd buried in the yard. Nobody can talk you out of doing shit when you've made up your mind to hurt yourself, right? As the movie finished in L.A., Jenny left me. For her, it was a life and death decision. She feared the base was going to kill her if she didn't escape. My bitch left me and I went crazy. I was convinced that Jennifer was cheating on me. That's why she left. That's what was really driving me crazy. At first, I hired various dealer lackeys to tail her. Then one night, I decided to punish her myself. I trapped her in the bedroom and nearly strangled her to death while repeating, "Jenny Lee, today you're going to die." But I fell in love with this pipe. The pipe controlled my very being. This motherfucker say, "Don't answer the phone, we have smoking to do." But the pipe's talking about, "Now come on. Don't put me down any place where I might fall, because it's 2 a.m. and it's hard to get one of me." I had the same suspicions about people who worked for me. I feared they were stealing money from me, making business deals I didn't understand. I didn't know whether I was paranoid or not. In my state of mind, it didn't matter. But just to be safe, I began withdrawing large sums of money from the bank and hiding it in lockboxes at home. I was high around the clock. I was paranoid. I was sad. I cooked up base in the kitchen and ran to my bedroom where I smoked it. I had conversations in my mind with everybody, entertainers, presidents, all of them. That was a strange place. I was doing so much I embarrassed cocaine dealers. They said, "Richard, man, goddamn, come on, shit. Why don't you just snort the shit?" "Okay, yeah, I'll just snort it." "How much you want?" "A kilo, just for the weekend." Football Hall of Famer Jim Brown tried to intervene. Jim Brown asked, "What are you doing?" "Free base." "What's free about it?" After cooking up a fresh batch of rocks one night, I walked from the kitchen toward the bedroom. To get there, though, I needed to walk down a long hallway. About halfway through, I was confronted by an apparition. At first, it was too far in front, dancing through the walls, too quickly for me to get a long, clear look. As I took another step, it sprang out from the wall right in front of me, and I saw that it was me. Skinny, orange-skinned, wearing black underwear. I was the devil. I pranced around myself in fiery circles, playing, laughing, closing in, weirded out. 8 months before, when Dirty Dick had started me freebasing, he promised I'd see God. Motherfucker. Look who showed up instead. The devil. Are you really me? I asked. Yes, I am you, the devil incarnate said. Then he, rather I, disappeared inside the wall again. In the instant, I sprinted into the bedroom and locked the door. I fought the urge to open it a crack and look back, certain that if I did, I would die. The motherfucker. And I knew why he was there, too. He wanted to kill me, put my ass out of its misery. 26. After freebasing without interruption for several days in a row, I wasn't able to discern one from the next. Night and day became different shades of gray, nor did I care about such details as time. But after waking from a short, unrefreshing, troubled sleep late on the morning of June 9th, I drove into Hollywood, where I entered my bank and demanded all the cash from several large accounts I had there. My brain was strung out. That morning smoke-a-thon rekindled my paranoia that people were stealing from me. I wanted my money. While I was ineffectually arguing with the bank manager who explained that he needed prior notice for such a transaction, Jennifer called my house and pleaded with my Aunt Dee to get me help. She'd never seen me so wasted and sickly. When Aunt Dee reassured her that I was fine, Jenny made a beeline out to Northridge in order to confront me herself, but the sight of me in the dark, clutching my pipe, told her it was useless. I know what I have to do, I mumbled. I brought shame to my family. I've hurt you. Destroyed my career. I know what I have to do. Shortly after she frustrated herself out the door, Deborah phoned me. We hadn't spoken for almost a year, but she felt compelled to check in and see how I was doing. It was as if she and Jenny, the two people who didn't give a damn about my power trips or being cut off, sensed it might be time to say goodbye. They knew it was a scary time. You're the only one I trust, I told her. They're trying to get my money. Who is? She asked. It's not fun anymore, I mumbled. What's not fun, Richard? I don't think I can get out of here, you know. The house was full, from Rashawn to my cousin and Aunt Dee, not to mention the housekeepers and cook. People were doing their thing. They were trained to leave me alone. Oh, Mr. Pryor, he's in his bedroom. They didn't mention that the door was locked. By late afternoon, the only reason to suspect I was present was the continuous smell of acrid smoke and the foreboding vibes that sent into the rest of the house. Nothing changed as darkness took the heat out of the beautiful spring day. Hovered over my rocks, pipe, cognac, and Bic lighter, I smoked and soared and crashed and smoked again, repeating the deadly cycle over and over again, as if I was chain-smoking Marlboros. But I didn't allow time even for cigarettes. I never felt more paranoid, depressed, or hopeless. Hopeless. As if I was drowning. Voices swirled in my head, so that I wasn't able to tell which came from me and which were hallucinations. My conversations became animated, like those crazy people on the street. I heard people who had worked for me talking outside the bedroom window. They were loud, rude, laughing, angry. They made fun of my helplessness,
I yelled at them louder and louder, and still they refused to answer. What the fuck are you doing out there? As that craziness went on, I continued to smoke until I ran out of cocaine. By then, I was experiencing serious dementia, stuck in a surreal landscape of constantly shifting emotions, no weight, floating at the distant end of a tunnel, miserably alone, frightened, voices growing louder, closing in, wave after wave of depression, needing to get high, real high. No more dope. Unsure what to do, I panicked. God, what do you want me to do? I cried. What do you want me to do? I didn't wait for a response. I'll show you, I said, with the giddiness and relief of a certified madman. I'll show you. More laughter mixed with tears. I'm going to set myself on fire. Hysteria. Then I'll be safe. Yeah, then I'll be okay. Now here's how I really burned up. Usually before I go to bed, I have a little milk and cookies. One night I had that low-fat milk, that pasteurized shit, and I dipped my cookie in it, and the shit blew up, and it scared the shit out of me. Not the blowing up, but the catching on fire. Imagining relief was nearby, I reached for the cognac bottle on the table in front of me and poured it all over me. Real natural, methodical. As the liquid soiled my body and clothing, I wasn't scared. Neither did I feel inner peace. I was in a place called there. Suddenly, my isolation was interrupted by a knock on the door. A bang, really. My cousin opened it and looked inside at the moment I picked up my Bic lighter. I saw him trying to figure out what I was doing. Come on in, I said. He zeroed in on the lighter in my hand. Oh, no, he exclaimed. Don't be afraid. Then I flicked it. The lighter didn't work. I tried it again and nothing. Then I did it a third time. Whoosh! I was engulfed in flame. Have you ever burned up? It's weird, because you go, hey, I'm not in the fireplace. I am fucking burning up. Instinctively, I jumped on the bed, thinking that I'd grab the comforter, wrap myself up, and smother the flames. But God's wonderful. That comforter was just laying on the bed, not tucked in or anything. But the damn comforter wouldn't come loose. Wouldn't let me pick it up or wrap it around. It wouldn't move an inch. It was just stuck. Ah! I screamed. I was in a place that wasn't heaven or earth. I must have gone into shock because I didn't feel anything. I sat on the floor when my Aunt Dee rushed in. She peeked in the room as if she was scared at what she'd see. I motioned her to come in. Smother him, she yelled to my cousin. What the fuck you talking about, smother him, I said, though I don't know if any sound came out. In my mind, I thought that smother him meant something bad, like, put the sorry motherfucker out of his misery. Still on fire, though unaware that I'd turned into a human barbecue, I rubbed the back of my head and looked at my hand. Flames arose from my skin, scared the shit out of me. I screamed, what the fuck is that? You're on fire, my auntie exclaimed. And then to my cousin she barked, put a sheet over him. Again in my delirium, I thought they wanted to kill me. Taking advantage of their confusion and horror, I leaped up and jumped out the window. That really took them by surprise. Sprinting down the driveway, I went out the gates and ran down the street. Come back here, honey, my auntie called, but I kept going. Running, running down Parthenia. I was out of my mind. Catching on fire is inspiring. They should use it for the Olympics. Because I did the 100-yard dash in about 4.6 in the underbrush. There was a lot of traffic on Parthenia. I saw people looking at me, you know, and I couldn't understand what they were looking at. It felt like a parade. I wondered if I was missing something good. A
but they were looking at a man burning up. And you know something I noticed? When you run down the street on fire, people will move out of your way. They don't fuck around. They get the fuck out of your way, except for one old drunk who's sitting there going, "Hey, buddy, can I get a light? Come on, pal, a little off the sleeve." By the time I hit Havenhurst, my pace had slowed to a walk. A police car pulled up. Two cops tried to help me. I tried reaching for one of their guns. They could have blown my fucking head off. I wanted them to shoot me. Hoped they'd finish what I'd already started. But I had no fight in me. My hands and face were already swollen. My clothes in burnt tatters. And my smoldering chest smelled like a burned piece of meat. They held me as an ambulance pulled up and helped get me inside. "Oh, Lord, you got me now," I muttered. Then my Aunt Dee, out of breath, bless her heart, got there. She climbed in and started talking to the ambulance attendant. More conversation I couldn't understand as they began treatment for my burns by covering me with a fluid-treated sheet. The siren wailed. "Is there?" I asked. "Is there what?" someone asked. "Oh, Lord, there is no help for a poor widow's son, is there?"
27. At the Sherman Oaks Community Hospital Burn Center.
"Do you know who I am?" the man in the white coat asked me. I said, "Do you know who I am?"
"Yeah," I said. "You're the doctor." In the background, I heard people whispering that I'd fucked up, that I'd fucked up royally. You can really tell when you fucked up because the doctor goes, "Holy shit, why don't we just get some coleslaw and serve this up?" They wrapped me up in cloth shit. I complained that it felt tight. The pain was so bad, I turned numb. "You're going to touch me first, then I'm going to die?" The burn center's waiting room turned into a circus of the most concerned. My family filled the place. Aunt Dee, Uncle Dickie, Maxine, and Shelley. My kids also came in case they needed to pay their last respects. Some in the group couldn't wait for the outcome. They simply went back to Northridge and picked the house clean of jewelry, televisions, and shit. But that family shit was kid stuff compared to the way God was torturing me. For having transformed myself into a human torch. Physically, I was scarred from the tip of my ears down to my thighs. The most severe damage was concentrated on my upper body, where third-degree burns turned what was once smooth, unmarked brown skin into a raw, fleshy paste that oozed brown pus and left the nerves exposed. Emotionally, I didn't know which way was up. I have only vague images of calling my agent and asking him to get me the hell out, an orderly asking for an autograph, not permitting Jennifer to visit, my way of punishing her for God only knew what, probably for getting clean, Jim Brown guarding the door, Deborah wincing at the sight of me. To be sure, I had the look of something created by a Hollywood special effects department, wrapped in gauze, slimy stuff dripping down my face, moans coming out of my mouth, but little registered with me other than the sheer, ceaseless pain. The intensity was punishing. It drove me in and out of consciousness. I conversed with God, pleading, cajoling, trying my best to get his attention. Finally, I heard him respond, "Richard, this fire is too much. I'm going to relieve you for now. I'll call you later." He kept his word, too. One day the male nurse who cared for me, a big black man with incredible patience and kindness, entered my room holding a sponge for me to see. He showed me both sides, one soft, the other full of little bristles. Didn't look like much, and the way he described it to me in a real, slow, even voice, made me feel like a kindergartner. This guy, Larry Murphy, would come in, and he kept talking to me every day. He said,